On this episode of the Naturist Living Show, the Bear Boutique and the history of Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park.
This episode of the Naturist Living Show is brought to you by Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park. At Bear Oaks, we offer traditional naturist values in a modern setting. Free your body, free your mind. www.bearoaks.ca.
Welcome to this latest episode of the Naturist Living Show. Well, it's actually been 2 years now since I first started recording and producing the Naturist Living Show, so it's yet again another bit of an anniversary. So thank you all of you for listening. My name is Stéphane Deschaines. I'm your host for this episode of the Naturist Living Show, and I'm also the owner of Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park. So last week, in my blog entry, I announced the launch of the Bear Boutique online. The Bear Boutique is the store at Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park. It's not a big store, but we do have a fair number of convenience items, pop and drinks and snacks and anything you might need while you're staying there for a short period or a long period, whether it's toothpaste and you might have forgotten your toothbrush or you need ice for camping. But I'm also trying to make the Bear Boutique a real resource for naturism. What I always say is, you know, when you go to the museum, and after you come out of the museum, there's the museum store, and there's all kinds of materials and books and movies and videos and things that are related to what you just saw in the museum, and that reinforce that message, if you will. And I want to do the same thing at the Bear Boutique. So the Bear Boutique has had a number of books, and very carefully selected books, by the way, not 100% about naturism even, some about body image and things like that. And, you know, there hasn't been certainly in Canada, there hasn't been an online retail outlet for a lot of these materials since Malcolm's nudist store went out of existence a few years ago. And so I thought, well, maybe we should make these materials available online as well. For people who are, like yourselves, listeners from far away and might be interested in some of the materials, and for people who are not regular visitors to Bear Oaks, and sometimes for people who have visited Bear Oaks and after the fact decided that they wanted to get some materials, but they don't actually live in the area they were vacationers. So we launched a Bear Boutique, and I think it's important because I think you have to have something to counter some of the other online retail operations that purport to be naturist. And it's actually something that I find very upsetting and irritating to see what people call naturist or nudist, because they are exploitive, they're using naturism, they're hiding behind naturism in some cases. It gives us a bad image, it makes us look bad. Of course, we have no control over the term naturist or nudist. Anybody can call themselves that. But I think the basic philosophy of acceptance of self and others and not using our bodies as a tool of exploitation to and over-sexualizing ourselves or anything like that, I think that's fairly basic. Yet people have these websites where they're selling these videos, for example, and that are really exploitive. They don't promote a healthy body image, a healthy image of self, because they tend to be very focused on young, shapely women. But sometimes it's even worse than that. I don't want to specifically name, actually, any place, because I don't want to give them any extra publicity that they don't already have. But the sad part is most people would come across these websites quite easily if they just searched for terms like naturism, family, kids, children. And I don't think they're at all targeted towards naturists. I think they know exactly who their customer base is, and I'm fairly certain they're not naturists. But they call themselves naturists in order to give themselves some credibility or to protect themselves from being charge as distributor of, well, of child pornography. Let me give you some examples. Here's this one particular website. It has lots and lots of videos, maybe hundreds. I haven't counted them. Here's one example. It says, mothers, daughters, and friends enjoy a day together toning with gym equipment followed by aerobics. 70 minutes long, $60. Now, you know, why would you want to watch 70 minutes of mothers and daughters just using gym equipment? And I haven't seen this particular one, but I've seen some from this company. And it is exactly what you hear there. There's no editing. There's no. It's like watching somebody's, you know, unedited video of some activity. In this case, doing aerobics, which of course is a little bit, can be a little bit sexual depending on how people look at it too. Here's another one: yoga, naturist style, whatever that means. Females only, meditating, stretching, 60 minutes, $60. Again. Why is it important that it's females only? Unless, you know, if would a naturist really be interested in this? Here's from another category called Family Portraits Number 3. Three Czech families celebrate the Yuletide. Happy times. 60 minutes, $60. Now, I don't know if I saw this one, but I saw a very similar video to this one. And it was exactly that. It was basically 60 minutes of somebody's home movies. Not really edited at all. Yes, they were nude. Yes, they were three Czech families. And as a matter of fact, all they spoke was Czech. So these are not sold exclusively to Czechs. They're sold a lot. This is a North American company. There's no voiceover. There's no translation. There's no subtitles. There's no music, in fact. It's really 1 hour of a family with lots of kids celebrating Christmas in their apartment, nude. Now, don't get me wrong. In these videos, it is naturist. I can't say there's sexuality, not from by my definition of sexuality or most naturists' definition of sexuality. These are real naturist activities. In fact, that's what makes them kind of so banal and boring to watch, because it's just everyday people doing regular things. They just happen to be nude. And if you're a naturist, that's certainly not a big deal. So I can't imagine why any naturist would want to watch 1 hour of family and, you know, unwrapping presents around the Christmas tree nude without being able to even understand what they're saying, because it's in Czech, without any kind of editing, because it's really their home movies. It's pretty bland if you're a naturist. So who would pay this kind of money? I think you're starting to get the idea, though. You know, here's another one. Year 2002, Junior Miss Pageant is a new video that's available. Introductions, pool antics, and the nudist contest itself. It says, please note this title is not available in Germany. You wonder why. Everywhere in the world except Germany? Must be something special about this video. This one is 85 minutes, so it's $140 for this one video, and because it's brand new as well, I suppose. Here's another brand new one. The best raw, unedited footage never before released of Junior Miss Pageants. Contest 7, 9, and 11, stored in a vault until now. Again, 80 minutes, and this one is $150 for one video that's 80 minutes long. That's not even the length of most feature movies that you buy, you know, Hollywood blockbusters that you buy. And yet they can charge $150. Obviously, they get away with it. And why would you want to see the raw, unedited footage? I mean, the other videos are basically raw, unedited videos from what I understand anyway. But here's one that's apparently worth a lot because it's raw, unedited, and presumably even more boring than some of the other ones. I don't understand. Well, I take that back. I do understand. I understand, because this company has been around for years. And no, you can't specifically pick on them for doing anything wrong, because the videos don't have sex. They don't have sexuality. They are really honest, naturist videos. They can be certainly accused of being boring, having poor production values, of not be very interesting because, you know, there's very little editing. but you cannot accuse them of having anything that is non-naturist. You certainly cannot see anything on the website that says specifically, you know, come look at naked women and get turned on. That's not what they say, but that is what they're selling. And in fact, it's a little worse than that, a little scarier than that, because almost every image of that represents each one of those videos, and I think there are hundreds of them, has children, mostly girls, but boys as well. Some are almost exclusively girls and boys. And so you wonder, how can this company stay in business for so many years and have all these videos at such high prices that are so boring to watch? Boring if you're a naturist, I guess. Not boring if you have prurient intents or prurient interests in nude children. This is what gives a bad image of naturism to some people who are looking on the web, because they'll say, see? And that's not what naturism is. They're just hiding behind that moniker in order to protect themselves from the authority. So that's why the Bare Boutique is going to go to extreme lengths to not carry anything like that. Hey, that might be very profitable. I'm sure it is. I'm sure if you can sell lots and lots of videos at $150 each, you make lots of money. But it's not about making money, or it's not just about making money. We do make money at Bare Oaks, and we will be profitable. But we will be profitable by offering people a true naturist experience, and we will do that through the Bare Boutique as well. So if you have a chance, come take a look at our website. Let me know what you think. It's www.bareboutique.ca, B-A-R-E, of course, like Bare Oaks, or like the Bare Bistro, the restaurant at Bare Oaks. And I'll put some links to the store in the show notes as well. We just had a members meeting at Bare Oaks. We do that every fall, kind of go over what's happened for the year and what the plans are for next year. And it's fairly popular. We filled the room pretty nicely with probably about 60, 70 people. If all 500 members showed up, we'd have a problem because they couldn't fit in the room. We don't have a room big enough at Bare Oaks to do that. I guess in the future, maybe we'll have to get an auditorium or something. But anyway, Eric Jarvis showed up. And if you've read the history of Bare Oaks on the Bare Oaks website, you know Eric Jarvis is the one who bought the land and made it the first naturist club in 1972. And he came to the meeting. He's a member at Bare Oaks, and he came to the meeting, and he presented the club, myself and the club, with an old picture of the very first clubhouse, which was not the building it's in now, but one that we now call the Outback, and a frame picture and a little history that was also framed to put on the wall. And it reminded me that I first met Eric quite by accident, actually. Eric owned the property from 72 until the early 90s. I have to look at the exact date. And then he sold it and it became a private textile campground, and they went through a few iterations. So he was far removed. But when I first purchased the club, I was very interested in the history. I knew that from 1972, there was the Toronto Helio Society that was on the land that is now Bare Oaks. And I did some research and various books and found some information about Eric and his wife, June, and what they had done and how they had started. And I put that on the website and in the history section. And so the very first summer that I was there, we changed the name and put the sign up at the front. I was coming out of the office, and there's an older gentleman just wandering around the parking lot looking a little bit around. And so I went up to him, like I do with anybody who seems to be new, and I said, how are you this morning? How can I help you? And he looked at me, and with a British accent, so I'm not even going to try because I can't do a British accent, but you have to imagine it. He says, sir, young man, I used to own this place. I said, oh, well, you must be Eric Jarvis then. He said, how did you know my name? And he was quite surprised that I would have known his name and known as much of the history. So we chatted for quite a while, and I gave him a tour, and he seemed to be quite tickled to see how things had progressed in his absence and how things had been brought back to what he had originally started and wanted to do. And so he's come several times since, and he's joined, and he's a member, and he participates quite a bit. Sadly, June, his wife, passed away a number of years ago. But it's really great to have Eric come by and be able to tell us about why things are the way they are and why things were designed and built the way they are, and participate into the club in the 21st century. So I sat down with Eric about 2 years ago, actually, and interviewed him about the history of the club, because I wanted to save that for posterity. It was before I even thought about doing a podcast. And so I thought I would share that with you today. Now, I apologize. The first 5-6 minutes, the quality is very poor, and that's because there was a technical problem with the recording. Keep going. Keep listening. It gets much better. And I hope you enjoy this interview.
So, how did you first become interested in naturism or nudism?
Well, I was living in England at the time, and about the age of 16, 17, I was wandering along the seashore near where I was living, and I came across a couple who were completely nude. Of course, I was amazed, but I got talking to them, and it turned out they were the owners of the only nudist park in the whole of the west of England at that time. In fact, if you found Bristol on a map of England and drew a map completely south, at all of the west of that line, all the way down to Penzance, there was only one particular official nudist park in that part of England. And, of course, being a young unmarried male of, say, 17, I couldn't join their club, but I did go down to where their members would go and swim in the nude at a local beach, which was at the very end of a public beach, and nobody used to walk along there. It was about a mile one way to cross shingle in order to get there, and nobody bothered except people of the club and people like me who were interested. So, and in any case, even if I had been able to join, I wouldn't have been able to join because they were a long way from where I lived, plus I would have needed transportation, and I would never have been able to afford the fees. But I did become interested at that point, because it's a very nice way to swim if you live on a seashore environment, and that's the best way to swim nude, of course, and so I was hooked from that point. And then later on, I went to the beach, which historically, for those people interested in history, it was a place called Slapton Sands in Devon, and it was used by the Americans to practice landing beach raids on what would be France at D-Day. And they were using the shingle beach because the Canadians, in their ill-fated raid on Dieppe in 1942, found that their tanks would not go up the shingle and they were stuck at the waterline, and they never made it into the town of Dieppe in order to fight Germans. And so the Americans were practicing on the shingle beach. Now, in actual fact, when they did land in Normandy in 1944, on the 6th of June, they found beautiful sand beaches that, of course, had hedgehogs and anti-mine obstacles and guns on the cliffs and all the rest of it. And I've walked those beaches in person, of course, a couple of times in my life. And it's interesting to think, in France anyway, the pillboxes are now all painted up with nice colours and serving ice cream and topless ladies walking around on the beach, which is what is common in Europe anyway these days. So, anyway, I then went on, and I had a few girlfriends, and I used to suggest that we go down there, so we did that, and then I went into the Air Force. I finished my apprenticeship as a carpenter, and then I went into the Air Force, and when I came out in 54, I worked again as a carpenter, and I used to still go down to this particular beach. And then it turned out that the lady who became my wife, her parents had been nudists, but they had never said anything to me when I knew them. And there was a place in my hometown where there was a private house, and maybe they had it now and again in the summer. It was a very easy and primitive, unofficial thing. And so she wasn't all that averse to being in the nude with me when I went to the beach. Excepting she didn't really like it, and I do know that one time she was in her costume at the nudist beach, and there were ladies saying, "Why don't you take it off, and she got very annoyed. Well, anyway, we then ended up coming to Canada, and
we went to and heard about Carl Rooley's place in Sun Valley Gardens near Fenwick, and I didn't tell my wife what we were going to do, and we did have our eldest son as a child at that time, a fairly new baby. He was walking. And so we went in, and then, of course, I said, now we're exactly, the campground we're doing is a nudist park. And she got all upset with that and immediately went down onto the floor of the back seat and hit her face, and she said, I can't go in here. And I said, well, don't worry about it. It'll work out all right. And then I said, no, we've just come to a sign. Well, she said, what on earth does it say? And I said, well, it says, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. And she started cursing, I don't care a damn about the Romans and all the rest of it. And the next thing I knew, we were at the prescribed campsite, and we got out, and I said, well, we're here now. And after about an hour, she felt quite comfortable. And then I had a game of volleyball. Now, I'd never played volleyball in my life. I was about around 28 or something at the time, 28, 29. And I know that I was shouted at by Carl and some of the other members, you can't play volleyball. If you don't know how to play, get off the court, and words to that effect. And even though I had plenty of time to play volleyball for the rest of my younger life, I never did. I was put off completely because of that incident and never played again. So then we decided that some other time we would also go down there. And so as soon as we stopped, the young boy, he ran immediately down towards the swimming pool. And my wife ran after him. And at the same time, the voice of Carl Rooley boomed out, "We don't allow young children around the swimming pool. Can you please grab him up?" And he was very annoyed. And even though she was there within split seconds, I got a little bit upset. I said, "Listen, I don't need you talking to my wife like that." And goodbye. So we went out, and we went further down the road to Shirkstone Quarry in those days, which was near Port Coburn. This was not a nudist place, of course. And there was a 30-degree drop in temperature between Toronto and Shirkstone. It wasn't so bad at Sun Valley Gardens, but it was a cool day to drop 30 degrees one day. Anyway, we then decided that Sun Valley Gardens wasn't for us, and perhaps we should apply somewhere else. We found out about Glen Echo, which was the TGS club in those days. And before you were allowed to be a member, you were interviewed in your own home. So we were interviewed by a couple, and I guess they found we were happily married. We had a child, and we had some experience of nudism. And so we were accepted, and we were able to go, and we joined. We had a tent site at Glen Echo. And then we had our second child came along, and I couldn't stand the screaming on the first weekend we had the child out. And so the following weekend, I had a used travel trailer, a 17-footer, and of course they never did have electricity and water piped into any of the sites. Most of the people were allowed to build little sleeping shelters and huts of some description. There was never any real worry what they put up, as long as it looked half decent. And it was a very, very pleasant experience for many, many years. And eventually I became the social secretary, which was an honorary post. and I used to look after dances and social activities until one day I came back from vacation and somebody said to me, "Hey, Eric, you've lost your job." And I thought to myself, well, this person doesn't know where I work. And I didn't think I'd lost my job. I was the manager of a particular complex at the time, and I had no knowledge of these things coming along to hit me. But it was the job of the honorary social secretary that I'd lost, because apparently Eddie had decided that he wouldn't maintain it as an owner alone, run by a committee of the members. He was going to do everything himself. And, of course, one of the things that he did or had to use was an Olga Stettner duplicator, which whoever was the secretary running the dances would have to run the duplicator. Well, it was at the very time that photocopies were starting to be known. And when somebody said you can get 100 copies for $3 down the road, there was no point in messing myself up with ink and all the rest of it and costing a lot more to be grinding out and working a handle with all these copies. So I never used a duplicator. And in the end, after I'd been 10 years at the park, he said to me, "Where is this duplicator? I promised it to a church club." And I said, "Look," I said, "I had to move it from every room in the house, and I asked you several times to come and pick it up, and you didn't." And I said, "I just threw it in the garbage." Well, he said, "I can't accept your check for renewal," he said, "unless you can produce the duplicator." So I phoned Gestetner and tried to get an antique, and it was no good. They were just old fashioned and not used anymore. So I was drummed out of the club, basically, and I decided after about 6 months looking that I would do my own thing. Right. So my check was refused in October of 1971. And when I got home, I immediately thought to myself, well, I would really like to have a nudist park of my own, and I started to look around for property. And I saw the place that I eventually bought, but some reason I couldn't come to any agreement with the owner. I had a third party there who was supposedly helping me, but he didn't, perhaps. And so I looked at a number of other properties, and then I went back by myself and saw the owner in April 1972, and we came to an agreement. And the price, I think, was around $37, as you were, $37,000. For 50 acres, and I had a 5-year mortgage, and the owner was a man about 80. I actually ended up with 50 acres, and this consisted of three fields, a river running through the Black River, a bridge over the Black River, and nothing else. Okay, so then I had to think to myself, what am I going to do with this place now? It was very, very secluded. The first clearing was about 1,000 feet in from the road, completely hidden from sight. There were a lot of trees, and of course the grass was quite high, about 2 feet. In actual event, it wasn't extremely high, but it needed cutting to walk around. And then I thought, well, I'll do several things, which meant I brought my Airstream trailer up and parked it from Toronto. And then, of course, the first thing we would want was a well for water. And I went into Sharon and asked the well digger, who was out at the time, if he'd come and dig a well. And his wife said she would pass it on to him, but he didn't come the following weekend either. So I then called in again and said, would you still ask him to come? And he still didn't come. So I thought to myself, well, I will call every well digger in. Obviously, asking him to come at 2 o'clock on a Saturday or Sunday isn't the way to do it. So I called nine different well diggers, and said, come on the weekend, whatever time you want. And one of them out of the nine turned up. And I said, when can you start? He said, tomorrow. I said, the job is yours. So he went down 25 feet, and there was some very nice water in the other clearing there. And then, of course, I inquired about electricity. Now, there was a big problem there. We were too far away from the nearest customer of the electricity company who would bring in the electricity to us, and they wanted an arm and a leg to pay for it. So I had to leave it for a couple of years, and then somebody built further north of me, and that meant that I could get the electricity in. But I had to pay for the poles to come in, and then I built a barn which was made of wood. And I had somewhere then to put in some equipment, tools, and various things, because I was starting to accumulate some of the materials and equipment that I needed. The first machine I bought was a combination tractor with a front-end loader and a backhoe on the end. And I kept that one for 20 years, as it turned out. And that was very useful for grading the road and heaving stuff around and starting to cut down a bunch of trees in order to put the future lake. Because if you don't have somewhere to swim in a nudist park, you may just as well not be in the nudist business or the recreation park business. So over the years, I ended up putting in the lake. Eventually, I put in an addition. And of course, I used to have prospective people coming and saying, usually from Glen Echo or from somewhere else, who were interested in seeing what I was doing. So unfortunately for me, I had a job that I had to hold full time in order to pay the mortgages on my house and the property. And I had to spend each weekend working, doing things, clearing the land, cutting down trees, all kinds of things. And these people would turn up and see no facilities because they were under construction, and noise of tractors and engines and generally they would think, jeepers, nothing's going to happen. And they would basically say to me, well, when you get a little bit further along in your plans, Eric, we'll come back. And I never saw them again. So I was really losing all kinds of prospective members and didn't realize it. Now, what I should have done was to have listened to a fellow called at Four Seasons. What was his name? Hans at Four Seasons, who sat down with me once on the field at Glen Echo and said, Eric, I've just bought myself 50 acres down at Freelton near Hamilton, and I'm going to make it into a nudist park. He said it consists of a nice lake, a house with a small swimming pool in the basement, used to belong to a doctor. And he said, you can come there any time and plug in electricity and water and you'd be in business. So in theory, I should have invested hundreds of thousands of dollars into the place, put in all the facilities, had a grand opening day, and all I would have heard would be people walking around, what a lovely place, what lovely facilities, I like your pool, I like this, I like that. And that's the way that it should have been done. But of course, I couldn't afford it. I had to hold a job down to pay for all this. And of course, it didn't take very long before I decided that I wouldn't be able to live on my job for very much longer, because I would need to do something else. Now, I did have a very good job. It paid more than average. And I was actually a combination sales representative calling on architects and engineers and promoting a particular waterproofing system for things like sewage disposal plants, water reservoirs, and such civil works, which, of course, all need extremely good waterproofing jobs, because there's always a pumping station with expensive equipment on one side and maybe 30 feet of water on the other. So I did that, and I helped with estimating. The company I worked with also started a contracting company at the same time, and I was very busy. And then in the end, I thought, gee, I've got to do something. I've got to have my own company, and I thought I'll do the same sort of thing. I named the park Toronto Helios Society for a simple reason. Helios was a Greek god who rode through the heavens on a chariot drawn by horses, and it has something to do with the sun. I forget exactly what it was now, but it seemed like a good thing to do. And because my main competitor was called TGS, having one called THS seemed to be a good advertising idea. So one of the big disadvantages that I found in 1972 was advertising the fact that I had facilities for nudists, because in those days the Toronto Star, which was the best newspaper in the area for ads, would not accept anything saying, as you were, advertisement for nudists to come to nudist facilities at a nudist park, because there were only a few, and it was a no-no to have the word nudist in writing in any kind of publication, in the same way that they had a code of ethics in movies at the time. You couldn't say certain things, and you couldn't run around in the nude or even partly nude. So it was a very repressive era, but you had to live through it. So that was a big difficulty. It was getting the ad in, and eventually I did, but I didn't keep any of them. I forget now how I managed to do it. But it was a piece of stonewalling by authorities who didn't want to help you in any way. But I then found that all the money I was earning as a contractor, and I was pretty successful, it was all going in the facilities that I needed to build up the club. Now, I was one of the school who thought that if you have a trailer or a motorhome eventually or anything like that, you want to come into a place, a resort, and you want to be able to plug in electricity immediately, have water, drinking water, safe water, and carry on from there. And at Glen Echo, of course, the owner didn't believe in that sort of thing for trailerists. And so people had to bring water with them and take their battery home every few weeks and charge it at home and bring it back fully charged. And it was quite a hassle. And it was a complete and utter nuisance. You could only use 12-volt things at Glen Echo. And, of course, I wanted to use 110-volt appliances, blenders and coffee makers and all the other things. So I had to work hard starting to get a few of these things in. Then somebody who was a member said, what you definitely need is a clubhouse, Eric. So in case it rains, and then we can have a dance and maybe a sauna and this sort of thing. So I built that in the mid-70s. Then, unfortunately, he died of cancer, and he never got to see the completed building. But I had that, and then I had other things that I gradually added to at the time. But I still didn't seem to be able to bring in the membership that I would like, which I needed to meet the ever-rising expenses. I was very lucky in running a successful contracting company, and I did very well financially. But it all kept going out fairly fast, no matter what I tried to do, and all the expenses and improvements I was doing didn't seem to bring in any more income. So I wasn't all that worried in most of the 1970s, because in 1978, I decided that I was going to build my house. Now, I should tell you that before I did this, I had applied to the local town, and I did this when I bought the property and said I wanted to run a nudist park, And of course, I'd never even heard the words nudist park. I remember being there in front of the council and the mayor, and the mayor was a lady at the time, and they had no conception whatever about how the rest of the world lived. And these were people that were basically farmers. They never went any further than the next concession, and they knew nothing of world affairs and the fact that this was a very good movement to be involved in if you were interested. So they turned down my application that I would like to have a nudist park. So for the first couple of years, I stayed dressed mostly, but when I felt like taking it off, nobody was there, I would do so. And it then, of course, progressed in the fact that nobody's there to complain, and I may just well run it as a nudist park if that's the way I want to do it. However, eventually they got wind of the fact that I had trailers in there and various things were happening over which they had no control. And when I submitted plans for a house, they said, well, you have got to move all the trailers off the property, and then we'll send in an inspector to see that it's as vacant as it should be, and the land has to be rezoned from rural to open conservation. So I said to the building inspector, why don't you just imagine that all these trailers are gone and just stamp the plans as approved, and that would save me a lot of aggravation. And he said, oh, no, he said, I can't do it that way. And he said, I'm a bureaucrat and I'm controlled by bureaucrats, meaning the council, and you're going to have to move all these trailers. Well, there weren't very many at the time, about a dozen or something like that. So I got friends to help me, and we drove down the road to a friend's place who had a whole bunch of trees and a field behind that nobody could see from the road. And so we drove them down there one weekend. Then I called the building inspector. He came in, he looked at the empty fields. He said, right, he said, you have now conformed with the rules of being open conservation. And here are the plans. They were already stamped. I don't think anybody had bothered to check them for any reason. And then I had permission to build the house. And the following weekend, I went down and brought all the trailers back again. And that was the end of that little debacle, as the French would say. So I then started to build the house. Now, I got some plans which I drew up with the aid of an architectural draftsman working for an architect. And what I should have done now in hindsight, I should have hired somebody to come in and dig the excavation. But I frittered away a lot of the summer doing that. It was quite a hard job with limited equipment and limited time. And then, of course, I subcontracted out the block work. And then when that was done, I went up to National Demolition, which was up the road in those days, which sold used building materials at a good price in those days, not now anymore. But they did then, and I got steel beams going right across the width of the building, around 28 feet long or something like that. They were 15 inches deep. And it never occurred to me to put in columns to support the beams or anything like that, because I didn't need it. I built it like a commercial building. Anyway, there were many, many interesting things happened to the house. And in fact, we had one member who was a priest. He lived in Barrie, and he would come down. Of course, he wouldn't be dressed as a priest for these occasions, and he'd be undressed like the rest of us. And when I was not going to excavate underneath the garage, he said, "Why don't you excavate it?" He said it would be a nice room for a billiard table. Well, this was a room 24 feet square, and it would have taken a 6x12 table. So I said, yeah, well, that's a good idea. So we should have named it the Priest's Hole, but we never did. And so that's why there is an excavation underneath there. I had steel beams across there, by the way, because I could take my bulldozer in on sleepers then and spread the load, and then I could do maintenance and engine work and all the rest of it on the dozer. It would take it all because there's steel beams underneath the garage. I should say that by this time, I was getting a bit tired of contracting. It was hard doing it without very much skilled help. I phased the job out, and then I went to work again for another 4 years, from 1980 to 84, with my previous employer. And he had some interesting new systems, and I was very happy there. And I remember being in Washington State and Washington, D.C., in the month of April 1984. And I thought that was a bit much traveling, and I was doing a couple of construction shows at that time, which is standing around on a concrete floor showing your stand to people, et cetera, et cetera. And it was just shortly after that when he said to me, "Well, I don't need you anymore, Eric. You've done a good job. Goodbye." And I was then faced with the fact, well, I can't really continue financially on subsidizing the whole of the nudist population in the area, because I may have only had about 85 members at the time. I'd like to talk about my wife, June, because from being uncertain in the days when we went into Sun Valley Gardens, she became very enthused about being a nudist. And I remember that we changed from a tent to a trailer when our second son was born, and we ended up with three sons under 3 years old at one time. And the last one, he was born on a Saturday, and he came out to the park on the following Friday. In those days, there was a five-day affair when you stayed in hospital for babies. And the middle one was born on a Wednesday and missed that weekend, of course, but the following weekend he was there. And my eldest son was born in November. Of course, he had to wait until summer came around before he came out to the park. But they were all very interested in helping me doing what I had to do. As the boys got older, they soon learned to drive a vehicle, operate the backhoe, work the tractor, the bulldozer, and help around the place in various construction techniques, which were very important for me to get help. Where the lake was built, the first lake that is, which is down by the bridge that went through, it was all originally woods. So what we had to do was to cut down by hand or chainsaw the trees and lug them over our shoulder. We had no equipment immediately then, and lug them out, because the backhoe had to then dig out the broken trees and the earth as well in order to make the lake. And then, of course, he left it all piled around the side, and that's how it was left. So I went to some local people here in the area that had bulldozers and said, "Would you come and grade me round?" And some of them said yes, they would the following weekend, but they didn't show up. So I called them again the next weekend. No, they still didn't show up. So I went up to Orillia, where there were some used bulldozers for sale. And the guy said, "Do you know how to use a bulldozer?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, there's a big pit out the back." He said, "Just go out and work the levers and do what you can do." So I started off trying to dig down to the center of the earth, and then found that didn't work. And I said, "Yes, I'd like to have this one here," which was an old model, but it did have a six-way blade, and it had a Perkins diesel engine. It was very good. And in a few days, a driver appeared at my trailer and said, "I've delivered your bulldozer and it's down at the front gate." So I went down. Of course, I didn't know how to start it. I hadn't been shown how to start it at the time, and I forgot to ask before I left. So there was a bozo that I didn't know what to do. And along came a local farmer, and that was one way of meeting one of the neighbors. It was a very charming fellow. And I said, I don't know how to start this. Well, he said, you have to turn on the fuel with this, and then you do this, and you do that. And the next thing I know, there was a satisfying roar. And the next thing happened, I'm driving up to the up to my trailer and said, look what I've just got now, I said to my wife. Now, she was always very helpful, of course. She was a teacher, and so she had a full-time job. But she used to help me, and she did a lot of the cutting down of the original woods in order to make the hole for the lake, and she helped me in every way possible, and she was very, very good with the members, and they all liked her. She was very, 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 very pleasant to everyone. Helped in countless ways, and of course we did a lot of socializing, potluck suppers, and all that kind of thing. I had been thinking for some time that maybe I would end up by having to change to a clothes facility, and when I brought this up to June, she kept on saying, "No, let's give it another year, and then another year," and that's why it all dragged on. But when 1984 came along, when my job was phased out, I said, now this is the time, we just have to do it. And she was reluctant, but I said, no, we have to do it. And so when I brought this to members and said, look, there just isn't enough money in it for me to keep on endlessly subsidizing this way of life, even though I like it, they all quit en masse, and I was left with no members at all. Well, time went on, and then we got into 1992, and I decided that I'd like to retire. So I put the park up for sale, and I realise now in hindsight that what I should have done was to have kept it and maybe hired a manager if I didn't feel physically on doing all the work that was entailed. But I didn't do that. I sold it. And my aim was to retire and travel and do all kinds of interesting things. But it didn't work out that way. But life is full of changes, so I ended up living in a cottage near Lake Simcoe, a little bit north of here, and I'm quite satisfied with what happened.
Well, that's all for this episode of the Naturist Living Show. Thank you again for listening. You'll find links to all of the items I mentioned in the show notes, the Bear Boutique and the history about Bear Oaks and that kind of thing, as well as a video of Eric Jarvis when he was running the place as the textile campgrounds. Unfortunately, he had to do that because financially they were having some difficulty. So go to the website at naturistliving.bareoaks.ca. That's B-A-R-E, of course. And keep sending your comments and suggestions. I always enjoy reading them. The show's email address is naturistliving@bareoaks.ca. And join us again in about a month for the next episode of the Naturist Living Show.
This episode of the Naturist Living Show was brought to you by Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park, traditional naturist values in a modern setting. Traditional values means that naturism is more than just taking your clothes off. It is a life philosophy with physical, psychological, environmental, social, and moral benefits. Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park strives to promote those naturist values in a modern setting that provides the amenities and services that our members and visitors expect. Free your body, free your mind. Learn more at www.bareoaks.ca.